Good afternoon. My name is Joanne, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Community-Based Transition Care Program. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you'd like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. I would now like to hand today's call over to Ms. Mandy Cohen. Ma'am, you may begin your conference.
Right, thank you, operator. And good afternoon, and thank you all for joining. This is Mandy Cohen. I'm the Director of Stakeholder Engagement for the Innovation Center at the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. So, again, thanks for joining us on this call for the Community-Based Care Transitions Program. We have a packed agenda for you today and some great speakers, and then hope to get to all of your questions. Just a few housekeeping items just up at front so you know that this call is being recorded and will be posted on the Care Transitions website within a couple days. This call is for stakeholders only. It is not for press. If you are a member of the press, please contact the Medicare and Medicaid Services press shop. And then lastly, if you do have questions at any point and if we're not able to answer them on this call, you can always email our email address at caretransitions@cms.hhs.gov. And so let me quickly review the agenda for you. First, we're going to have an overview of the partnership for patients amongst which the community-based care transitions is a part, presented by both Dennis Wagner and Dr. Paul McGann. And then we'll be joined by folks that work closely with Community-Based Care Transitions Program, Julianne Tungsten, as well as Ashley Ridland. And then we have a special treat where we've invited all of the original awardees, this first round of awardees for the Community-Based Care Transitions Program, to join us to share their experiences with you. And then we'll open up for some questions and hopefully get to all of you and answer your questions on the phone. Again, if we don't get to your questions, we have an email address, caretransitions@cms.hhs.gov. And so with that introduction, I would just like to turn it over to Dennis Wagner, who is one of the co-directors of the Partnership for Patients.
Very good. Thank you, Dr. Cohen. I'm absolutely delighted to be here today with my co-director, Dr. Paul McGann. We're going to do kind of a tag team presentation here over the course of the next 7 minutes or so. I also want to acknowledge that we're particularly happy at this stage of the game to be on the line with 7 community-based partnerships who will begin receiving payment for their care transition services. We're delighted with that because, one, they were accepted and enrolled into this program, and that's great. And secondly, we want more of these successful collaborative partnerships to be approved for the Community-Based Care Transitions Program. That's really our point with this call. We want to do as much as we can to give the stakeholders who are on this call insight into what makes for an effective application, are the kinds of things that are being approved today so that we can have more successful applicants to this program. Our secretary, our administrator, our principal deputy administrator want lots of action and lots of learning and lots of results from this program and from your work. So we are thrilled that I understand there are already more than 500 people enrolled into this call. We think that's fantastic. And wanted to be just crystal clear that the purpose of this is really to enable in every possible way we can those of you who are joining us to be successful applicants as we go forward. And, of course, to answer your questions and be as helpful as we can be on that regard. So with that, I'm going to turn this over to my co-director in the Partnership for Patients, a geriatrician, a fine leader, Dr. Paul McGann.
Thanks very much, Dennis. And as you know, Dennis, over the last 2 years here at CMS, we've just had one of the most privileged episodes of both of our careers in working with Administrator Don Berwick for the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, who's really exerted, I think, leadership like we've never seen before in healthcare in this country. And he and his principal deputy administrator, Marilyn Tavner, have espoused consistently, even before Don came to the agency, what he calls the three-part aim. And really, that's what the partnership is all about. The Partnership for Patients is our first attempt to operationalize the three-part aim: better care for patients, better health for the population, and lower cost through improvement. We've only learned in the last 10 years or so that better care can actually be less expensive, not more expensive, and there's no better illustration of that than the Community-Based Care Transitions Program. In the Partnership for Patients, we have two main quantitative goals: a 40% reduction in preventable hospital-acquired conditions over 3 years and a 20% reduction in 30-day readmissions over the next 3 years. If we're successful in that second goal, of which the Community-Based Care Transitions is the biggest support network, we will have helped 1.6 million patients recover without complications over the next 3 years. And in the process of meeting both these goals, we'll save the American taxpayer over $35 billion. Now, what is the Community-Based Care Transitions Program, and how does it form such a big part of the Partnership for Patients? Well, the technical direction of it, for those of you who haven't followed the origin of it, is in the Affordable Care Act, Section 3026. And this part of the legislation puts $500 million out to test models for improving care transitions for high-risk Medicare beneficiaries. The money's available for the next 5 years, with the potential actually to renew and expand it for five additional years if this first 5 years proves successful. And so I think we're going to dive right now into a brief description of the goals of this and also the unprecedented opportunity that it affords for every single one of you on the call. And we would want, in an ideal situation, for all of you to submit applications and be approved. Dennis?
Yeah, thank you, Paul. So the key goals of this program really couldn't be more clear. They come right from the statute. The three key goals are to improve care transitions and therefore to improve care that occurs from patients moving from inpatient hospital settings to home settings or home health or other care settings. That's the first aim. The second is to reduce readmissions for these high-risk beneficiaries. We want the quality of their life to be better. We don't want them to be readmitted back to hospitals. And because of the reduced readmissions, that takes us to the third aim of this program, which is to document measurable savings to the Medicare program. So this is really an unprecedented opportunity. One way to think about it, it's an unprecedented opportunity for community-based organizations, together with their partnering acute care hospitals, to actually define and then price a new cost-effective care transition service for Medicare patients in their communities. That's really what's going on here. The applicants to this program have the opportunity to actually define and price a new cost-effective care transitions benefit that's tailored to the unique needs and circumstances of their community. I'm not aware of a single other effort like this in the history of the Medicare, but it really is quite extraordinary. But I do want to kind of underscore cost-effective. This is not a grant. It's not a contract. This is an opportunity to price a payment benefit and then to receive that payment benefit as Medicare patients are served through this program. But it's got to add up. That is to say, the cost of that benefit when applied to the patients who receive it has to generate more savings than they do in costs. So that's really key to successful application. Paul?
You're so right, Dennis. In the 40-year history of Medicare, there's never been anything like this even remotely thought of. So this is a unique opportunity to sit down, analyze your community, think about what's right for patients and their families, and come up with a way to deliver a Medicare benefit that isn't a top-down edict from us what you do, but what you think will work in your community. Now, it's linked to cost effectiveness, so you have to do what we've tried to do for 40 years here at CMS, and that is pay attention to that. But we're actually putting the control in your hands. You're the people that are delivering the care. You know what would work. We don't want to turn this into a new revenue-generating ability. We want this to actually work for patients and be good. Now, we're not going to get into all the details. There have been other programs on that before, but I just want to finish up with just touching the surface of what the rules and regulations are behind this, because it isn't a totally simple program. It's something that you do have to pay attention to the legal structure in the statute, and we're going to get more into the details of that, but I think it's going to help you to have the actual first partnerships that have this award talk about their experiences, because you'll learn more from them than you would from me. But just at a very high level, who can be a community-based organization? I'm just going to give you some examples. Community-based organizations can be area agencies on aging, aging and disability resource centers, ADRCs, federally qualified health centers, QIOs and QIO partners, in any coalition representing a collaboration of community and healthcare providers, as long as a legal entity is formed. We have to have a legal entity because for a Medicare benefit, by law, we have to have a taxpayer ID number so that the payment for the service can be made. These are not, they're not contracts, they're provider agreements. The governing body has to have multiple healthcare stakeholder representation, including consumers, and there has to be partnership with one or more subsection D acute care hospitals, and the community-based organization has to be physically located in the community it proposes to serve. So to summarize, you're going to hear in the rest of this hour the most practical manifestation of this that we've been able to put forward so far in our education program around the Community-Based Care Transitions Program. You're going to hear from seven partnerships who are going to receive payment for care transition services, who have been successful in their application to CMS, and you're going to hear what made them successful. We want to encourage all of you to listen and ask questions and to be successful yourselves. We ideally would like every entity on this call to be successful in their application for this brand new and very unique opportunity. And finally, our administrator wants to see lots of action and learning in this arena going forward, and that will be done in partnership and under the structure that Dennis and myself and our entire CMS team are working to put the partnership for patients in place, together with not only the supports in the community-based care transitions program, but a lot of other exciting supports that are going to be announced by the secretary in the next few weeks. So at this point, we turn it over to
Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Cohen, thank you.
Thank you, Paul and Dennis. So I'm going to turn it over now to Juliana to give Johnson to give additional details about the program. Juliana, take away.
Thank you, Mandy. Just wanted to emphasize the community aspect of the program, that this program does build off of what was done in the with the quality improvement organizations in the ninth SCIP of our care transition subnational theme. And we're looking for community, true community approaches here, with as many medical and social service providers, downstream providers pulled into the partnerships as possible in the community. And so just wanted to emphasize that. We're also looking for multiple hospital partnerships, and you'll see from the seven sites that were selected that they all have multiple hospital partners engaged in their programs. So also wanted to stress that this is a rolling process. We are accepting applications now. You know, as applications come in, they get logged in, put in a queue, and get put before the first available panel. We have panels convening all the time. We do sometimes post review dates on our webpage and cutoff dates just to give people an idea of the time it takes between getting their application in and having it looked at. But just wanted to stress, you know, whenever someone's ready to get an application in, to not wait for any posted review dates or cutoffs, to just go ahead and get it in. So today we are going to focus on the key attributes of a successful application and have invited the first seven sites selected for participation in the CCTP to aid us in this endeavor. And so it's my great pleasure to introduce the seven sites that were initially selected for participation in the program, which are the Atlanta Community-Based Care Transitions Program, the Akron-Canton Area Agency on Aging in Akron-Canton, Ohio, the Southwest Ohio Care Transitions Collaborative serving the Cincinnati metropolitan area, and surrounding counties in Kentucky, Indiana, and Ohio, and the Southern Maine Agency on Aging, Aging and Disability Resource Center, the Area Agency on Aging, Region 1 in Maricopa County, Arizona, the Elder Services of the Merrimack Valley, serving the Merrimack Valley of Massachusetts, and 10 bordering cities in southern New Hampshire, and the Council for Jewish Elderly, also known as CJE Senior Life, in Chicago, Illinois. I'm going to now turn it over to Ashley Ridlon, who's going to facilitate and moderate a question and answer session.
Great. Thank you, Juliana. And thank you for the 7 participants who've joined us today. Congratulations. We know that this program, as Dr. McGann and as Dennis Wagner mentioned earlier, is very different than a lot of the programs that we've seen before. So we know that you're pioneers here, and just appreciate your being here to share with us the experience and kind of what it feels like to apply to the program and to apply successfully. So thanks for being here. We wanted to turn to each participant and ask very specific questions of different areas of the application and kind of what that experience was like for you. So we'll begin with the Southern Maine Area on Aging, the Southern Maine Area Agency on Aging. And this question is about the root cause analysis process. We asked the applicants conduct a thorough root cause analysis of the readmission drivers in their communities. So this is not a literature review. We really do, as Juliana mentioned earlier, want you to look very specifically at the needs of your community. And so we'd like to ask Lawrence Gross to begin with kind of a 3 to 5 minute presentation on what that root cause analysis process looks like in their community in Maine and what those findings were. So I'll turn it over to Lawrence Gross.
Thank you very much. Well, our root cause analysis is covering a 5-county catchment area, so it's not a community at large, but we worked with our partner, Maine Health, which is a hospital health system, and 5 of their community hospitals members. And we partnered with Maine Health's Center for Quality and Safety, which collected a lot of data from the individual hospitals and then rolled that up into a regional analysis for us. Some of the sources that we used for our data included PEPR reports, HCAP reports, care transition measures. We had data that was available to us through a state organization called the Maine Health Data Organization. We also reviewed process measures from our care transition bundle. We have a bundle of services in the system looking to improve the transition from hospital to community. We also conducted a retrospective review of a randomly selected number of patient records looking at information related to their admissions and discharges. We held focus groups with 26 providers to kind of get their feedback on what they saw to be some of the challenges related to transitions. And then we also conducted a small number of interviews with patients. The results of all of that indicated that really there was a pattern of readmissions and point to opportunities for community-based interventions that would support a safe transition. For example, biggest causes that we found in our root cause analysis were problem medications, with more than 93% of the people involved indicating that that was some kind of a challenge in their transitions. The other area was polypharmacy, and polypharmacy is described by us as more than 5 routine medications. Over 100% of the patients that we reviewed had multiple medications. The other was the principal diagnosis. More than 70% of the people that we looked at had problems with some of the principal diagnoses in the Project Boost 8-piece screening tool, which would be things like cancer, stroke, COPD, or chronic heart failure. We did look at some information out of the what they call STAR reports, and we found that even in the hospitals that were practicing some of the care transition techniques, only 50% of patients had a scheduled follow-up visit after discharge, and of those who did have scheduled visits, only 43% did not keep their appointments. 30% didn't understand their medications, 30% left the hospital unprepared to meet their health care and health care and health management responsibilities. So as a result of all of those, that review, we focused in on the care transitions initiative because we felt that that would be the best way to address these issues. And our project goal is to expand the care transitions intervention across all five hospitals and do that in depth with the ADRC, providing a critical linkage back to some of the community supports that many family members indicated were challenging for them, for example, getting transportation back to medical appointments and things like that. That's it.
Great. Thank you very much. So we'll move on from there, and we'll also ask that you, if you have questions, we'll have time at the end of the call to do Q&A. And I also just wanted to mention, we've just gotten word that the first five summaries of each of these participants' programs are now up on our website. I know the other two will be coming, but we wanted to, you know, kind of rather than go through each individual detail of the program on the call today, make those summaries available to you. And so those are up and available now. So now we'll turn to Kathy Berger of the Atlanta Regional Commission and ask a little bit about establishing the partnerships in the community. The Atlanta community is working with six hospitals. They're working with the QIO, with aging services organizations. And again, this really speaks to that community effort and really rallying around the patients in that community. And also may turn to Dr. McGann and to Dennis Wagner to speak about the value of partnerships. I know this is a huge focus of the Partnership for Patients and looking to leveraging the commitments of our partners. So we'll start with Kathy Berger and then turn over to Dennis and Paul for their reactions.
Thank you very much for this opportunity. And let me begin by telling you that there were really three factors that we believe contributed and facilitated our partnerships with our hospitals. And I think the most important one was that about 2 years ago, under the leadership of one of our hospitals, Piedmont Hospital, we started an Atlanta Care Transition Work Group in Atlanta, and for 2 years have really on a monthly basis focused attention on the issues surrounding care transition. So we really had a good ground work in the whole area that I think did help us to start talking about this to our particular hospitals. The second, I think, contributing factor was that as the Area Agency on Aging, we started a pilot program, a very small pilot program, to prepare us for the submission to CMS. And with that, we worked with three hospitals and put into place a coaching model along with a supportive service program. And again, it gave us background and it gave us a sense of what we had to do to apply to become a provider for CMS. And then I think the third factor was that we did have a long-standing relationship with our QIO, the Georgia Medical Care Foundation, and that when we turned to them for assistance, it was a very easy process for us. We have really three sets of community partners, and of course the first one would be our six hospitals. And we chose those very carefully and with much consideration and involving everybody in the decision. Of the six, two hospitals were on the list for the high readmission rates that CMS put out. So we had two hospitals falling in those categories, and they were selected with the help of our QIO. And then we had four hospitals that were somehow already involved in doing care transitions internally. of those four, three were working with us in our pilot project, and the fourth one was working with the QIO in the scope of ninth scope of work. And then I have to say that the six hospitals serve a 10-county area, and they are, two of those hospitals are really serving large, diverse patient populations. These are all pretty big hospitals and, you know, serving a very diverse group of individuals. Our second partner was the QIO, as I mentioned, and I really encourage every AAA and every other provider who is looking at enrollment to be in close contact with their QIO, because I believe we got tremendous support. They helped us when we did not know the hospitals and their hospital staff. They were the ones that were arranging the meetings for us and even accompanied us on our first meetings. Then the other help that we received from them was with the root cause analysis for us to understand it and to help us see what we needed to get from the hospitals and work with the hospitals. And then the third item they delivered to us was the readmission data. The information we received were critical in completing our application. Our third set of partners were our community-based organizations. We will be using the Coleman model, but also have added a supportive package where we, for 30 days, provide home-delivered meals and in-home support and transportation services. And for that, we have turned to our traditional aging services network. We already have contractors and providing these services, and we were able to expand those contracts to include the package in our offering under this program. I would just say that to anybody going out there, it's good to build on existing relationships. We certainly did do this. When we did not know the hospital, we turned to the QIO. And also to note that we did not start with the hospital CEOs. We started with people we knew who were social service staff, the quality improvement staff, anybody we knew in the hospital setting, and said, we want to come and talk with you. And from there, they were the ones, once convinced about the program, that could take it up the ladder. And then by the time we were asking for firm letters of commitment, those came from the CEOs with full support from the hospital. So that's basically our process and what we have done. So there to answer questions later.
Great. Thank you, Kathy. And I'll just turn just for maybe a 60-second reaction, if you can, Dennis or Paul.
Thanks, Ashley. I just have to compliment Kathy on the description there. It just brought me back a few years to my 25 years in clinical practice as an internist and geriatrician at the front line, and really remembering those years. And I think anyone who's practiced with the frail elderly in the modern hospital system in America knows that the systems that evolved in this country over the last 30 or 40 years really aren't friendly to these relationships that Kathy talked about. They aren't friendly to patients. They break everything down into silos and reward procedure-driven specialties and do not reward the people in the community or the doctors who try to make connections and create nets and fill in the gaps and make patient care whole again. And it's so frustrating in clinical practice, I know, because I went through it, that these gaps keep opening up, and every time you try to fill them, the system, and the reimbursement system in particular, pushes you away from that. And so these relationships and these reaching out and these partnerships and linking things together are really the key to healing the healthcare system. And I think a lot of people talk to Dennis and me about how complicated the new healthcare law is and community-based care transitions and how can anybody understand it. And it is true, there's a lot of technical detail to get through. But in the end, it comes down to one simple fact. And the simple fact is the existing healthcare system makes it hard to do the right thing for patients. And these new programs are working. They aren't there yet, but they're working to make it easy to do the right thing. And the Care Transitions Program, and especially these first instances of the Provider Agreement Awards, you're starting to hear now the healing of the American healthcare system, and people who know how to do the right thing have been trying to do it for years but have been prohibited by the restraints of the system. The program like this and other programs that we're creating are starting to make it easy to do the right thing. And I think as long as you believe that and as long as you act in a leadership way on that, I think you'll eventually get your application together and you'll eventually get the help you need, and it'll become easier and easier as you get into this swing of things. The other thing I wanted to just briefly mention that Kathy talked about was this linkage to the work we've been doing the last 5 or 6 years in the QIO program, and I'll ask Dennis to make that link because it's no longer restricted to just 14 sites as it was in the Knight scope of work. We now have these resources available all around the country, quite deliberately and by design, in this current 10 scope of work. Dennis, you want to just say a minute about that?
Yeah, I'm very grateful to our guest speaker here from Atlanta for bringing up the collaboration that their partnership had with the QIO program. Because as Paul said, we now have, as part of the QIO contracts that exist through all 50 states and 3 territories, we have built into that contract that the quality improvement organizations are available to assist communities in the work of submitting application for this 3026 program. So if you're interested and you've not yet reached out to the QIO, please do so. It's a tremendous resource, and I'm delighted to hear about the partnership that occurred there with the QIO and the Atlanta community. Great going.
Great. Thank you, Dennis and Paul, and thank you again, Kathy. So we'll turn now to Roseanne DeStefano, who will describe a little bit for us about the Elder Services of the Merrimack Valley. This is a participant that will be covering 33 towns in the Merrimack Valley of Massachusetts and southern New Hampshire. And we wanted to know a little bit about kind of how you conducted your community-specific root cause analysis and then used that to very specifically choose an intervention strategy that targets the root causes that you found in your community. And this is one of the key points that we are looking for in applications, is that again, it's based on your community needs. So we'd ask Roseanne to speak to that, if you could.
Hi. Can you hear me okay?
We can hear you.
Okay, good. I found this part of the application to actually be the most fun, because it was really the opportunity to put to match the interventions that we had learned over the years, as a community-based organization. We intuitively knew a lot about what works and doesn't work for older, people, and to put that together for the first time, with root causes that we were able to identify. Similar to what has been said before in terms of the process of root cause analysis, there was certainly look at the literature, there was certainly look at research that had been done, but I found the most telling and the most fruitful piece of that root cause analysis was really through the focus groups and talking with people at all levels of the continuum, from skilled nursing facilities, assisted living, certainly housing, board members, patients, hospital discharge planners, everybody along the continuum, and each one asking them what they believe happened and why. And some of the hospitals that we worked with had done some work internally that we were able to use their data in terms of looking specifically at root cause. Some of them did that specifically only for some diagnoses, so we had to take a much broader approach and say, okay, what would be the root cause for all kinds of readmission? So our root cause analysis piece, you know, was the first step, certainly. And we were able to kind of cluster, if you will, the root causes that we found into about 7 different categories. We saw perhaps the most obvious was inadequate care coordination. And that's just what it sounds like. All the times that there just isn't that kind of care coordination that really drills down to the home level that hospitals often don't see, don't know really what is going on at home. The second thing was that the second category was health systems failures. And that really is where it's not about just what the hospitals didn't do. It's about what we all didn't do and where things fell apart. And looking at the failure, health systems failure, it largely comes down to the human error part of poor communication. There is just so many different examples where the expectation of discharge was different. People didn't understand the next level of care and what was going to be available at that point. The communication to the skilled nursing facility or the certified home health agency was not adequate. The third category was poor patient and caregiver understanding, and this was very, very large. This was a big part of the readmission rate. And certainly it became even more so when in the Merrimack Valley we have a very diverse population, a lot of Cambodian and Hispanic and a variety of different other groups where language also becomes a barrier. But this was actually not so much about the language but just not understanding what the next steps were and what they needed to watch out for. The next category was behavioral risks. And really, that was another one that was not really a surprise, but it was a surprise, I think, in the sense of how many people fell into that category because so many of readmissions were due to anxiety. And that may be with a formal mental health diagnosis or without one. But what we found is that there's just people use the healthcare system or overuse the healthcare system because of that kind of behavioral risk. We looked at not only the caregiver as well as the patient themselves. So that was number 4, and number 5 was environmental risks. And this is where I think the community-based organization has an advantage of actually being in the home and knowing firsthand what person is going to go home to. The number of environmental risks can be from safety issues how the home is designed and that's those kinds of things. Next was clinical risks, and obviously this is the most, I think we expected this in looking at the polypharmacy issues, complex chronic conditions, and then finally cultural barriers. And this is what I spoke to earlier. And it's not only the language, but the culture that would oftentimes form a barrier for people to get the kind of care that they should be getting. We looked at our interventions, and then matching interventions with these root causes was the interesting part. And certainly by our experience with the Coleman model, certainly proved that the Coleman model had to be the basis, the number one intervention that we wanted to choose. We chose to enhance the Coleman model so that we could actually add pieces such as home safety checks, follow up with PCP, and some other pieces that we felt were so critical and was so much a part of the root causes. But then we also took a look at a lighter touch transitional care where the person went to the skilled nursing facility and then went home. Some of the other interventions were being able to have a rapid responder available when the person gets home. And not in all cases was services going to be available to the individual when they arrived at home. sometimes it's a new patient for a certified agency, and that they had to do an assessment process. And sometimes a person may not be eligible for services that, quite honestly, the discharge planner may have thought would have been eligible. So we looked at being able to pay for immediate home-based services for that first week of services and that day of discharge.
Roseanne, this is Ashley Ridland. I'm sorry to interrupt, but I just wanted to be mindful of the time and make sure that all of the callers have a little time to describe their programs, and then we can reserve maybe the rest of this for the Q&A if others have questions about the interventions. Would that be okay?
Sure. I'll just list them. The next one was interpretation. Then another intervention was mental health. The next one was patient self-management. The next is one-time basic necessities, then nutritional coaching, enhanced home health, and then the vast array of community-based services that was in existence that we would pull upon. Okay.
Great. Thank you. Thanks, and it's very exciting to hear you describe just what fun that was to really look at your community and see what those root causes were and how to address them. And we do encourage multiple models, but really the key here is making sure that those models address your community needs. So it looks like you've done a wonderful job there. So I wanted to turn next to Gary Cook of the Akron-Canton Area Agency on Aging. And Gary Cook, are you on the line? Okay, we weren't sure if we had Gary. So if he joins us, we can have him give his toward the end. So we'll go ahead and move to Sharon Fusco of the Southwest Ohio Council on Aging. So we wanted to ask you a little bit about how you chose to target the high-risk Medicare fee-for-service beneficiaries in your population. So how did sort of looking at your community and your community needs and the readmission patterns in your community work out for you? And then ultimately, how are you targeting the beneficiaries in your community?
Well, thank you, Ashley. When we started this process, in order to sort of get to a target population, we relied pretty heavily on a lot of data analysis of the admissions and readmissions were occurring in the facilities that were partnering with us. We have five hospitals in our partnership. And so we really started by pulling data to see, how many clients were being admitted and readmitted, what their diagnoses were, both their primary and their secondary, and getting a feel for how did those come together in terms of, what were the commonalities, what were the top diagnoses that were happening with these patients when they were being admitted and being readmitted. And we also used the same kind of data from the pilot study that we had here. What did the patients that were in our pilot, what were the conditions that they had going in and being, when they were admitted, and what were their primary and secondary diagnoses, how many of them had multiple chronic conditions and so forth. So we looked at it, we really did a lot of data analysis around the patients to really understand what was happening there. And the questions that we were trying to answer with that was, who was being admitted and readmitted, what were their diagnoses, where were the patients coming from? Were they coming, from the home? Were they coming from nursing facilities? Were they coming from other settings? So that we would understand how to, what interventions we should be looking at from the standpoint of where are they coming from. Also trying to get a little deeper into the root cause of their admission and or readmission. And then whether the other thing that we wanted to know was whether or not the intervention we were looking at was actually effective, and that's where the data analysis helped us with our pilot. Once they came in, and we targeted patients and looked at those that were that seemed to be readmitted, looking at our pilot data, saying, that, is this intervention going to work for people with those diagnoses? Because in our pilot, we had quite a range of admitting diagnoses. Once the data from the hospital showed that heart failure, chronic heart disease, and pneumonia were the top for us, as well as multiple chronic conditions, it was then going back to our pilot data saying, did the pilot show that we were effective with the care transitions intervention in reducing readmissions among people with those diagnoses? So it allowed us to sort of do a check and balance between what we were seeing happen in the community and whether or not the intervention we were looking at was going to work. We also looked at national data then. Once we had sort of a defined target market, we then looked to national data to see what was happening nationally. And we were looking at were the data aligned, and if not, where was the misalignment? Because if our community was pretty far off from what was happening nationally, we wanted to understand why that was so that we could understand if we needed a different type of intervention or if we needed to broaden our definition in a certain way and to make so that we could make sure that the intervention ultimately we selected and the way that we designed it would work. So I'm not sure what else to add to that, but that's how we use data to come up with our target population and used it to support the intervention that we selected.
Wonderful. Thank you for that. So we'll move next to Area Agency on Aging Region 1, which is in Maricopa County, Arizona, and hear a little bit about your previous experience. And we do ask applicants in their applications to describe their previous experience in improving care transitions. So all of these participants on the call have brought very valuable previous experience to the table and to the program. So we'd like to ask Mary Lynn Kastanek to describe your previous experience.
Okay, thank you, Ashley. In October of 2010, about a little over a year ago, we did two mini pilot projects, one with Banner Del E. Webb Medical Center in the Sun Cities area, and with Care First, a Medicare Advantage Special Needs Plan that serves dually enrolled Medicare and Medicaid beneficiaries in Maricopa County. And we followed in our pilot project the traditional Coleman Four Pillars model. And we identified some strengths and weaknesses, and so I'm just going to share with you quickly three lessons that we learned. One was that we realized that we needed more than the traditional two visits. And so we proposed that we would do a visit prior to discharge, one within 24 hours after discharge, and then a second home visit within about a week to 10 days. Because what we found was that after discharge, the clients, the patients, feel very overwhelmed. In the hospital, we've kind of done an introduction to what's going to be happening during the transition, and that's very valuable. And in that first visit, we go over the four pillars of the Coleman model, but we're asking them to, be looking at all of those different issues. And the Medicare beneficiaries feel overwhelmed. They have either a new diagnosis or there's a worsening of their condition. We've asked them to do a follow-up appointment with their PCP and their specialist and to pick up their prescriptions and, taking their new meds and so forth. So we propose then between that first home visit and second home visit, there would be telephone coaching and telephone reassurance. But then there would be that other follow-up visit to make sure that they're right on track. The second issue that we found is the lack of transportation. In our pilot of over 100 individuals, 46% of them lived alone and had no limited or no reliable transportation to do follow-up appointments or to go to the pharmacy to pick up their medications. So we're proposing two options to deal with that. One is that we have partnered with SunWest Pharmacy that's offered to provide prescription delivery to any of those CMS program participants that don't have family and no other way to pick up their prescriptions. And also we're going to be developing a consumer-directed transportation option to help individuals find either friends or neighbors that can help take them to their appointments. In our pilot program, we used some AmeriCorps members, and that really made a big difference. And so we think that that's going to be one of the most successful issues about the transition from hospital to home. And then finally, our pilot program, what we found that many of the individuals lived alone, as I said, and that they didn't have a strong support system. They were socially isolated, which led to depression, a lack of desire to care for themselves. They might be depressed about the worsening of their condition or a new diagnosis, and they didn't want to take their meds, go see their doctors, and so forth. So we proposed to conduct depression screening and then to refer the individuals to our area agency is a licensed behavioral health agency, and so we will provide in-home counseling or refer them or facilitate access to Medicare outpatient or inpatient behavioral health services. And we feel that this is also going to be another valuable component. And I'd like to just say in closing, of course, while we're in the home, as other people, speakers have pointed out, we'll be doing home safety checks and linking them to other home and community-based services that our area agency provider network currently does.
Wonderful. Thank you. And last but certainly not least, we have CJE Senior Life to talk a little bit about how to show us how you've met the eligibility requirements and the structure in your partnership. So rather than just sort of describing that you meet the eligibility requirements, really putting some justification behind that. So we'll turn to Heather O'Donnell to describe how CJE Senior Life has done that successfully.
Thanks, Ashley. CJE Senior Life is a longstanding elder care organization. We've been in Chicago and the northern suburbs for over 40 years, and we have a number of programs where we have actually focused on reducing rehospitalizations, and we sort of walked through some of those programs in detail in the application. We have a skilled nursing facility that has short-term rehabilitation, so to sort of demonstrate our previous experience in reducing rehospitalizations, we walked through our advanced practice nurse model in reducing rehospitalizations there. We also talked about our home health care agency, that we are a Medicare-certified home health care agency, and how we've reduced rehospitalizations in that area. And we also provide a whole host of home and community-based services in our community. And so we really walked through how we have been in our community and how we have been community-focused and patient-centered over the existence of our organization. In addition, we really focused on the hospitals in our community that have high readmission rates in the free hospital compare measures, and all of our hospitals would be subject to Medicare financial penalties if they're not able to bring down the 30-day readmission. So we really walked through that piece. We focused our model on hospitals that are doing an enhanced hospital discharge planning program, either Project Boost or Project RED. We really felt like this would be a strong signal an indicator that the hospitals are committed to improving the quality of care across the full continuum. And we are doing the Coleman model, which really takes those enhanced discharge planning programs to the next level. Another thing that I think stood out in our application is that one of the big focuses in our community, or one of the big needs in our community, is skilled nursing facility readmissions. So in doing the Coleman model, we're not just going to be following people that are going from the hospital back home, but also people that are moving from the hospital into short-term rehabilitation or long-term care. So we sort of outlined how we would have a strong connection with the skilled nursing facilities and home health care agencies. Another thing that we did is that we are going to be working very closely with the care coordination units in each of our hospitals that connect patients post-hospitalization to critical support services once they return back home for a short period of time, personal care, home-delivered meals, transportation. I think all the evidence really shows that those support services are really critical in making sure people stay out of the hospital after they've been hospitalized. And we are also working very closely with our local QIO on tracking readmissions to the hospital where they were admitted initially, and then other hospitals where they're readmitted in our community, and also following patients by the skilled nursing facilities and home health care agencies where they receive care post-hospitalization. So we really focused on a number of different aspects in our community.
Wonderful. Thank you, Heather. And so I'll turn now to Ray Thorne, who will move us into the next portion of the call, which is our Q&A portion.
Thank you, Ashley. Hi, everyone. This is Ray Thorne, and I'm with the Stakeholder Engagement Group and the CMS Innovation Center. We are now ready to turn over to go into the Q&A session. And operator, we are ready to open up the lines for Q&A. We ask that the callers, when they ask the question, state their name and their organization that they're affiliated with, and keep their questions brief as possible so that we can get to as many questions as possible in the time remaining. So operator, I turn it over to you.
Thank you, sir. At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Your first
operator.
Question. Yes, sir?
As we're waiting for people to line up, we do have some questions that Ashley would like to ask.
Great. Thank you, Ray. So as Ray mentioned, we'll give people a second to queue for questions. But I did want to highlight a couple of things that are frequently asked questions and ask if Juliana Tiongson, who's our program lead here for the Care Transitions Program, to kind of chime in on these. One of them is, as we were just hearing from Heather O'Donnell about the structure and eligibility of the applicants, what are some of the things that people need to sort of focus more on versus less? I know, you know, we need to make sure that people have partnerships in place and that is reflected in the application. So how does that sort of differ from other kinds of letters of support, and where should people focus their effort there?
Thank you. Yes, we need to see formal partnerships established with the critical partners proposed in an application, such as all the partner hospitals, downstream providers that are being involved in the collaborative, and the community-based organizations. So letters of support from the CEO, the CFO, and the head of discharge planning at each partner hospital are required at a minimum. And we also like to see things such as MOUs between partners wherever possible. Other letters of support from congressional staff and others that aren't really going to be a service provider in the partnership, they really don't provide a competitive edge to applicants. We really need to see those letters from the key partners. The other thing that I would mention is that to this requirement of the community-based organization to have multiple healthcare stakeholders, including consumers on its board, often isn't fleshed out in enough detail in people's applications so that we can make the determination that there are consumer representatives and multiple healthcare stakeholders on the board. So really laying out who the board members are and what their respective roles are is extremely important.
Joanna, excuse me for a second. This is Gary Cook from Akron Canton. We have been on the line, but we were having technical difficulties being heard, so I just wanted to let you know that we're here.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. And thank you, Juliana. I think we can turn to you, Gary, if you can give us in just a couple of minutes. We wanted to hear a little bit about your previous experience, and I know we've heard from others about theirs, but if we could kind of, you know, make sure to keep it short so that we can have as much time as possible for Q&A.
Sure. We've had a long-term strategic initiative of trying to integrate medical and long-term care. And, you know, as a result of that, as far back as 1998, we have had Area Agency on Aging long-term care nurses literally physically located in our area hospitals, in eight of our area hospitals. The original purpose of that was for transitions, but primarily transitions into our Medicaid long-term care waiver programs and to divert individuals from permanent nursing home placement. As we moved on into the future, we began to see the advantages, obviously, of integrating medical and long-term care. And later on in 2009, we developed a hospital pilot with two hospitals to actually do care transitions, much like we're doing now. Of course, the problem at that point was sustainability. But we used that as a basis to sort of learn our craft, if you will, and to also document the very real reduction in readmissions that we saw. Since that time, we've undertaken a contract with a Medicare Advantage plan to do transition coaching for them under contract for the once again for Medicare Advantage Advantage people. Beyond that, downstream, we've done several projects over the past several years, but I think one of the ones that has the most lasting effect in terms of enhancing the transitions and the ultimate outcomes of transitions are our interdisciplinary teams. In cooperation with the hospitals and the Area Agency on Aging, we have an interdisciplinary team that meets on a regular basis, comprised of a geriatrician, a pharmacist, an Area Agency on Aging case manager, a long-term care consultant or assessor, and on an ad hoc basis, a nutritionist, hospice, adult day services, and a CNS, which we have on staff. What these people do is take those hard-to-serve individuals and those difficult cases and then try to come up with, once again, interdisciplinary solutions to, once again, keep them from returning to the hospital, from having excessive ED visits, from permanent nursing home placement, et cetera. We have several other demonstration projects in the past where we work cooperatively with the medical care system, a couple of which have been featured in a new book that was out, The Comprehensive Care Coordination for Chronically Ill Adults, which was just published by Cheryl Schrader and Paul Shelton this year, in which it talks about two integrated models under best practices that we use, the SAGE project, which is the Summa Area Agency Geriatric Evaluation Program, and the PACE project, which is a program for all-inclusive care for the elderly, which is essentially our interdisciplinary team. So once again, we have a long history of working cooperatively with the medical community, and of course the problem becomes sustainability, and we're really grateful for the opportunity through the Affordable Care Act in this contract to take a look at making some of these more sustainable.
Thank you, Gary, and we're glad that you were able to join us and overcome the technical.
I've actually been listening to the whole thing trying to speak up, and you couldn't hear me, so I apologize.
No worries. At this time, we're ready to dive into the questions for CMS staff or for the site. And if there are any budget questions, please direct them to Juliana Tjonsson. So, operator, we have anyone waiting to ask a question?
Yes, sir. Your first question comes from Holly. Please state your full name and your organization.
My name is Holly Staley with SSM Healthcare.
Go ahead, Holly.
My question was, how many of you coordinated across healthcare systems, and of those, how many healthcare systems did you coordinate across?
This is Gary Cook from Akron. We coordinated 10 hospitals across 4 healthcare systems.
Likewise.
4 major systems.
This is Sharon Fusco from Cincinnati, and we coordinated 5 hospitals across 3 systems.
Atlanta, Georgia, we did 6 hospitals across 5 systems.
Heather O'Donnell, we did 3 hospitals, 2 systems.
This is Roseanne. We had 5 hospitals with 3 different systems.
And in Phoenix, we have 4 hospitals, 3 systems, and then other partners.
Good to hear your voice, Mary Lynn.
Great. Thank you, Holly, and thank you, everyone. Operator, next question.
Your next question comes from Pamela. Please state your full name and your organization. Your line is open.
This is Pamela Clifford from Hennepin County Medical Center in Minneapolis. I have 2 questions, actually. Most of you have been focusing on the elderly patient. As we're doing our root cause analysis, we are finding that over 50% of our patients are under the age of 61, and many of them have end-stage renal disease as opposed to the cardiac or respiratory diagnoses. I'm interested if there's anyone else, if in your root cause analyses, any of you of the 7 systems or efforts found that and how you addressed it. And then my second question is, I just need clarification. In every one of them, is it actually a transition coach from the Area Agency on Aging that is doing that function? Is it from the Area Agency on Aging that the transition coaches are coming from?
This is Heather O'Donnell from CJE Senior Life. We are not a AAA, and we're doing the Coleman model using a transitional care nurse. But we will be working closely with the care coordination units that set up the home and community-based services in the hospital.
Okay,
and
thank you.
In Phoenix, Arizona, it will be the area agency that is hiring and supervising the care transition coaches. And we also have senior care advocates that will be assisting them.
This is Roseanne DiStefano. The coaches will be from the Area Agency on Aging, from our agency. And in terms of the first question, we are an ADRC. We are comfortable working with people that are under the age of 60 and have worked collaboratively with an independent living center, and hope to find, you know, be able to use that partnership with the under 61 population.
This is Larry Gross at Southern Maine. We are including people under 65 in our project that are Medicare eligible. And as far as who's doing the coaching, we're partnering with the Physician Hospital Organization and embedding one of our community resource specialists onto the team. The coaching is being done by the PHO, and our person is participating as a team member.